At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare, all on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to Health Tech Hour this week with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, investors, CEOs and founders that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder myself of a business called PocDoc. PocDoc is a tech-enabled service platform that allows anybody anywhere to give themselves a full health screening in minutes, have it integrated back up into their patient record. And the current product that we have available is the Healthy Heart Check. So if you are looking to give yourself a health check that has been used widely across the NHS, head to pocdoc.co. That's P-O-C-D-O-C.co. So as ever on the show, I want to say thank you to anyone who's listening live on UK Health Radio. We love the UK Health Radio channel. We love having the live platform with them. And thank you to Johan and his team for all of the production. If you are catching us up on any of the podcast channels, thank you for listening. Our numbers are going up and up, and we really appreciate all of the feedback, all of the comments, all of the follows. Thank you very much. And please subscribe as well so that you can stay on top of all of the new shows that we have coming out. If you're catching us on our YouTube channel, it's good to see you. Or if you're looking at us on Instagram as well, our numbers there are really strong. So we're talking hundreds of thousands of views for each clip at the moment coming off of these shows. So thank you so much if you are tuning in from any of those places. On this week's show, it's been a while actually since we've had an investor on the show. They always provide a really interesting viewpoint. And I think that a lot of the information that you see in the media, particularly about health, healthcare, health products, health services, sometimes skips over the fact that these businesses need to be funded and often well funded. And so it's always really, really fascinating to have an investor mindset and investor viewpoint on the show, because ultimately healthcare businesses particularly generally need quite a bit of investment before they get going because of the unique nature of the healthcare space. So on to today's show, we have Jamie Tomalin, who is one of the leading investors at Triple Point Ventures, which is an early stage investment venture capital firm based in London that focuses on health tech and healthcare, among other things. Jamie is one of the thought leaders in the UK investment space on tech-enabled services, AI in healthcare, and supporting the entire health tech industry and its founders to grow and to scale. One of his particular areas of passion is in how to accelerate the adoption of healthcare businesses, particularly what's referred to as full stack technology businesses, which we'll go into on the show for those of you not familiar with that term. So Jamie, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Steve. Yeah, very well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great. So there's quite a bit that I kind of want to unpack with you onto today's show. So why don't we start first with why you think, or if maybe you disagree, what is particularly unique about healthcare and health technology that requires a specific investment approach, or a specific, why is it different potentially from other areas that that get investment and businesses grow and things like that? Because people do talk about health being different. So what's your view on that?
I think that in many ways it's not so different. And actually, so Triple Point, we're a generalist fund, so we invest across sectors. And the benefit of that is you see the learnings from different domains, and you can see, you know, how different business models work in different sectors, and bring those learnings into you know, sectors like healthcare. I guess one of the sort of, from a software investor's perspective, one of the differences in healthcare as a vertical, obviously everyone's aware that it's a large portion of GDP, but actually when you break down the revenue lines that entrepreneurs can go and attack, it's sort of, the data I've seen in the US, it's around 75% of the revenue is tech-enabled services in healthcare, and then sort of the rest being software. And so I guess maybe that's just being pure software. And I guess maybe that's one of the differences between some other categories, is that the reality is, you know, a lot of these solutions are around helping to deliver care to patients. And there's always going to probably need to be humans in the loop in a lot of those workflows, and it's unavoidable. And so there is just a sort of a more of a services element that I think is prevalent in healthcare. And I think that from a lot of early stage venture capitalists who sort of got a little bit addicted to the narrative around like software being more scalable, higher margin, et cetera, that's maybe turned some people off. And perhaps they come into the sector with different heuristics. So then when they meet a sort of early stage tech-enabled services business, which when you look at the course of how these businesses run, typically they might start with lower gross margins, and they see a business with maybe 25% gross margins, and they compare that to what they typically see in a conventional software company that might be sort of 80 to 90%, and they just run for the hills, right? So I guess there's a nuance in understanding where the revenue pools are in what is an extraordinarily large market, and also understanding how these businesses can mature over time and change. And often when you look at tech-enabled services businesses, maybe they start with relatively low gross margins, but over time, as they can command higher service prices, refine the processes slash tech for their care delivery, say, they can increase to 60% plus. So I guess maybe those would be some perspectives.
And when you say, let's, you know, we have a bit of a broad church in terms of a listener base. So when you say tech-enabled service business, what do you mean?
In my view, I'm thinking about, you know, companies that are trying to own the full stack of the solution they're delivering. So I guess within healthcare, this could be somebody that is not trying to sell software into therapists to help make the therapist workflow more efficient. They're actually trying to provide a new provider to deliver the service to patients. So building everything around how you deliver that care pathway, if that makes sense. So being full stack in that way.
Okay, so it's sort of end to end, trying to do as much of the clinical pathway as is possible. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. So I think you can fundamentally try and rethink the way that care is delivered.
Mm-hmm. So I think for us at PocDoc, that's where we've seen that, this is what we do around it as well, where instead of just being a diagnostic test, it's the test delivered, the full cardiovascular health assessment done digitally in minutes, the integration back up with the patient record, the ability to speak to a clinician through the application to understand what that result means, what treatment's required, and the ability to make any prescription or treatment decision off the back of that. So fully end-to-end and it going back up into the NHS digital infrastructure. That's kind of what you mean, right?
That's exactly right. And I think that, like, importantly, I mean, there's been quite a lot of inertia around like the broader investment community to invest in things that are seen to have a services element historically. But actually, you know, we've seen this enormous investment into AI infrastructure, right? You've got, I guess, NVIDIA is the proxy for that demand, but you've got all the cloud majors investing in like large CapEx. And now people are asking questions around where is the commensurate revenue going to be unlocked? And I think that, at least for me, there's a growing consensus that people are excited by the ability for AI to automate or augment workflows that traditionally were performed by knowledge service workers. And can you sort of use this technology to unlock what were traditionally, you know, human labor costs or FTE costs, and unlock that with AI? And this is where there's going to be, you know, this $3 trillion market of services that can now be unlocked. And so I guess in some ways there's more momentum around people willing to believe that these like tech-enabled services businesses can be scalable, higher margin, et cetera.
Because the automation that AI allows effectively creates that vision, or sort of accelerates it, enables it, makes it less human-oriented.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I guess like you're already starting to see maybe examples that I point to, you know, companies like Livy Cree Dr. Lib, who are reporting maybe, I think Dr. Lib reported about 20% time saving and Livy was about 30% in the admin time between clinician patient like interactions, right? And these are sort of like data points people are looking at and like, okay, at scale that's pretty interesting, but actually if you are the service provider, right, you can absorb 100% of that upside from that time saving.
Yeah,
and that just makes your business more efficient.
Well, and also, and that's just what it is right now, that's not what it could go to.
Exactly. And I mean, when you think about, I guess when I think about this, I know we're sort of jumping around slightly, but
no, sure.
We've had this sort of like initial rollout of people building co-pilots for XYZ, right? So augmenting existing workflows, and that seems to kind of be the approach of the incumbent. So Microsoft Copilot in the enterprise, or GitHub Copilot, and those are doing pretty well. They're sort of like AI upsells to existing products. So then you've got these sort of like autopilots that are looking to do the work or sell the work. And I guess the problem with selling in those sort of products is there is always going to be a inertia from a buyer to procure something that is essentially taking your job, right? What rational person?
Well, and also in healthcare, there's also clinical risk, right? So does the turkey vote for Christmas concept, and then there's the clinical risk, and often they get conflated, you know, like people use clinical risk as a reason as to why we need more humans in certain places. So I don't know, sensitive.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I guess if you are the full stack service provider, you're just in a stronger position to, for want of a better word, dog feed it into your business. So then capture 100% of the upside, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we've done work in this space and thinking around the diagnostic pathway for cardio, metabolic and renal diseases. And, you know, the sort of old school is sort of lab test is done. You know, lab test result gets sent to your doctor. You have to then go back to your doctor to have a discussion, maybe about some information on a piece of paper. And then after that, there might be another appointment to talk about what may or may not have to happen. So there's quite a bit in that you can automate. You know, there's quite a bit in there that you could improve efficiency around. And there's no reason why you can't conflate all of those appointments into a singular user journey for those clinical prevention pathways. And what we found is because we're able to, in effect, integrate back up with the healthcare system through all the various APIs that we have, the GP, which is sort of the gatekeeper at the moment, as you know, in the UK around patient data, fundamentally, your record sits with your GP.
Yep.
Realistically, the feedback that we've had is that we're able to go out and test people and screen people in areas of real need where they're not able or not willing or other reasons not accessing primary care. And prevention, particularly at primary care, is not as high priority as acute. It just isn't. So that we're able to go out and reach these huge populations. And the feedback we've had from the GPs is brilliant that you're out there testing those people and screening those people and assessing those people and providing that follow-on care pathway based on those risk assessments. And I see all of the information anyway. because it's integrated back up with my record. So I get the best of both worlds. My patients are being treated, tested, screened, treated, diagnosed, and cared for, but I'm able to interact and see that information as and when I need to. So it's the best of both worlds for them, because otherwise there's just this huge pool of unknown out there, which creates huge costs further downstream for healthcare systems and further pressure for primary care.
Okay, no, that makes a lot of sense.
So where do you see this sort of going? Do you think, how much of this is driven by AI versus, you know, just like, for example, if this AI explosion hadn't happened, would we be having this conversation? How much was happening anyway before the sort of explosion and growth in LLMs?
I think that things are already starting to happen. And I think there's like interesting examples of people who are thinking beyond just building software. But I think, as you'll know, like narrative is so important to fundraising. And I think this has been a huge tailwind or accelerant that I guess, like, cynically, even as an entrepreneur, you'd want to lean into. But I guess we've already seen sort of like people innovating in business models. So I guess there's this concept that's really taken hold more in the US of building sort of like businesses in a box and utilizing sort of like verticalized telehealth offerings. And so that could look like a business like Moxie in the med spa space, which essentially provides all the core admin infrastructure that you'd need to run a beauty spa practice.
Right.
And so it's almost sort of like a, you know, if you're a nurse who wants to start up one of these businesses, you can take all of their software primitives and they help you identify a good space to start the business and everything you need to actually like run it on the back end, and you sort of get up started more quickly, and then they charge you a sort of SaaS fee. That can, I guess there's sort of a number of ways these businesses sort of like help. So one is helping to alleviate the admin burden to run a practice. The other sort of wedge people use is to create distribution or discovery via marketplace, and then use that to connect with specialists. So for example, in like child's autism diagnosis, is a business called Finney that have like a marketplace where you can sort of like discover a specialist to help you get your child diagnosed. And then they provide a lot of services for those sort of like providers or clinicians to like join their platform, use all of their services to run the appointments, etc. But they benefit from the distribution of the marketplace. And similarly, a business called Grow Therapy, if they've done this in for therapists in the US. And I guess there's been a number of different examples of people taking that approach, which I think has been quite interesting. I guess like
why is it different to other things that you may have seen? Like, how is, what is, when you say you think it's interesting, just for everyone listening, like, give us an insight into what is interesting from an investor's perspective in those businesses.
So I think fundamentally, in some ways, people starting businesses in say the UK, just to pick on it specifically, like we suffer maybe from a little bit of maybe pride or the fact that the UK itself is a large market, but it's not really massive enough to support a venture scale outcome from a software perspective. So if you are literally, if you're trying to build a new digital health software service that you start in the UK, typically you're trying to solve a problem that exists in the NHS. I don't fundamentally believe that selling into primary and secondary care just in the UK is going to be sort of like, as a software provider, really a big enough market. You're going to be TAM constrained. But I think if you are the full stack service provider, actually your take rate and the margin that you can get and the value you can accrue is much larger. So it is actually feasible just based in the UK to get to the sort of scale where you can be generating 100, 200 million in revenue, which is what sort of early stage investors are going to be looking for companies that can potentially be worth, you know, in excess of $1 billion. And I think this is when you look at the, I guess this comes down to one of the first points I mentioned around like the size of the tech-enabled services TAM versus the software TAMs, and also when you look at and I guess this like leads to like the relative penetrations these companies need to have to become larger. So I guess like from my perspective, these people who are trying to in some ways, yeah, create sort of like the business primitives for people to be providing these services and like indexing that, or helping enable sort of like full stack provision of care via enabling the discovery initially, like the examples in autism. I just think that they're probably slightly default more ambitious and scope to be larger than just like providing a single SaaS solution.
Okay, I think that's that. We're going to pick this up. So we have to now go for our first commercial break. So we will be back after 2 minutes with Jamie Tomalin, one of the leading investors from Triple Point Ventures. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Jamie, just before the break, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour. Before the break, you mentioned a term a few times, which I just want to clarify for everyone, which is TAM, which is total addressable market. So that might not be something that everyone's immediately familiar with, but why? What is it, and why is it so critical for venture investors?
Yeah, so I guess the heuristics of an early stage investor, or I guess the VC model in general, is that the majority of the companies that early stage investors that they invest into will ultimately fail. Like, venture portfolios follow this power law distribution, and the vast majority of returns in any given portfolio tend to accrue to, you know, one or two of the companies. And so every investment that somebody makes, they need to believe can be that company that returns the fund. And I guess back solving from that logic, you need the company to be building in a market that is large enough to support an outcome to be sort of a unicorn, right?
Which is valued at over $1 billion or pounds.
Yeah, valued over $1 billion. I guess multiples are compressed now, so maybe you need that business to have, say, 250, 300 million of revenue. And so the reality is, if you're building in a market that itself is a total addressable market and existing spend in that market is only 300 million, well, I've got to believe that you as a company are going to get 100% penetration in this market for me to sort of have that outcome.
Which
is clearly difficult. So I guess, yeah, it's a roundabout way of saying that people are looking for very large total addressable markets that can potentially support these large outcomes.
So I think what's really interesting about venture capital, and that's why I kind of asked the question, is this concept of a power law. So I think that there's lots of people that think about businesses, and there are lots of businesses out there that could be successful and might be successful, and there might be customers. And, you know, like a really good example would be businesses that offer IT solutions to GP services, right? There's lots of there's lots of GP practices, and they all need IT solutions. That's a pretty good business, I'm guessing. You know, if you're in that business and you've got contracts, and they're probably really sticky and generate revenue, and you can do it profitably if you control your costs. But that isn't necessarily something that's going to get venture capital excited, because venture capital, like you said, follows this power law where any investment that they make needs to return the fund. And the fund may be valued, that might be 200, 300, 500 or more millions. So you have to believe in those businesses being enormous. And if they're not, they've got the potential of being enormous because the market isn't big enough, that's a no-go for you guys, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. And I guess this is also why, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to understand the size of the fund that you are being invested from. Like, if somebody is investing out of a 50 or 100 million pound seed fund, the outcome needed to return that fund is going to be lower than, you know, a bigger investor coming in, investing out of a $1 billion fund. It's just the reality, right? So I think it's always important to understand the incentives of everybody involved. And I guess there's even more nuance, right, depending on when in a fund cycle an investor is investing. If you are the first check out of a brand new fund, you are going to have more time as an investment to mature versus if you are the last ticket out of a fund, right? There's going to be a shorter time horizon that they're going to want you to exit as a business. So I think, yeah, as an entrepreneur, you've got to be acutely aware of who's investing in you, the dynamics of their fund, et cetera.
That makes sense. I think it's just, it's interesting because, you know, been through the journey myself on the journey, you know, a few times, not just with PopDoc, but previously. And it's a unique way of thinking about the world, you know, and it takes a while to understand it, I think, as an entrepreneur, because it doesn't mean that your business isn't good. Doesn't mean that you can't find customers. Doesn't mean that you can't generate revenue. Doesn't mean any of those things. Doesn't mean you're not a good entrepreneur or anything. It just means that for that particular fund, that they don't have a confidence in the overall size of your market, meaning they couldn't invest because by definition, you wouldn't be able to be potentially one of the winners at the level that they need you to be, which is just an interesting way. I mean, you used the way heuristic, which makes sense. It's like an interesting viewpoint, I think.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think actually one of the odd things that's happened in the last sort of 3 to 5 years is that lots of venture capital funds have become quasi media orgs, right? And they're producing so much content for leadership, have all of these vast followings. And it's almost sort of like distorting people's perspective of like what entrepreneurship and building a business is, right? Like going on the venture capital track is one very specific high octane way of building a business that really should only be attracting the most irrational, obsessed founders, because, you know, the reality is nobody really needs to build a $1 billion company and make that much money, right? You just don't really need to. And you can still create a huge amount of value in this world and improve patient outcomes by taking different routes. But I think we've sort of been slightly distorted by this sort of like barrage of media, et cetera, and thought leadership from VCs. But yeah,
that'd be. I agree. And I do think that there's like a lack of. So when I think about entrepreneurs, really entrepreneurs that have it really hard, I think about people running hairdressers or, you know, butcher shops or, you know, taxi businesses or whatever it happens to be, right? Like running a plastering company or a decorating company, like that's really hard, you know, like no, there's nobody you can go to pretty much for funding there. Maybe you can get a loan from the bank, maybe. Yeah. That's really hard. You know, the high octane is a really good way of doing it. It's like there are people that want to give startups, businesses money, you know, it's a very sort of privileged, but very different pathway. And I think that there's a bit of a lack of discussion or appreciation of those other pathways, you know, that like that there are other ways to build businesses and run businesses and be successful. So I think it's a really interesting kind of discussion and debate to be had. Because there's also a kind of a perception of sort of, you know, if you can't build a business that gets funded by venture capital, maybe you're not, quote, a good entrepreneur, which I think is insane. You know what I mean? And I think that creates this real like binary outcome to the whole proceeding, which I don't think you win or you lose. I don't think that's very helpful generally.
No, I completely agree. Yeah. And it's, and I think you get this sort of like the negative second order consequences is when, you know, becoming a venture back entrepreneur can be, glamorous, and then people starting businesses more for the ego or perhaps the like social bread / external validation that it provides, rather than actually wanting to like build a business and solve a problem. And I think that has lots of consequences as well. It's an interesting dynamic. I mean, ultimately, I think that like true people actually like are fundamentally entrepreneurial are quite rare, and yeah, they're a rare breed of people.
Yeah. So I think there's this guy Simon Squibb. I don't know if you follow him. Do you follow him, Simon Squibb, on Instagram?
I don't know, maybe I should.
Yeah, he's really cool actually. So he's like, I'm not sure exactly what his journey's been, but he's an older guy, but basically he's sort of built this huge following by going around and just sort of asking people in the street or driving a bus or doing the cleaning in the top, like what your dream is. And then sort of trying to help them get there and sort of challenging them. And like, he'll ask someone like, what's your dream? And they'll be driving the bus and it'll be like, well, I'd love to open up a food store. And then he'd be like, well, what's stopping you? And they're like, oh, I need some money. And then you're like, well, how much money? And the guy will be like, well, I need like 500 quid. And he'll say, well, if you quit right now, I'll give you 500 quid and we can do it together. And he'll sort of like forces people to think through how they can get what their dream is, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I think it's a really interesting approach. And his view, sorry to come around to it, is that in the UK, the education system is such that it sort of almost discourages that independence of thought and that sort of unique approach of what that you need to be able to sort of not just follow your dream, but actually sort of not just follow the prescribed career route, to actually sort of back yourself or at least have a crack. It might not work and you can always change and go do something else, but that sort of we've been so conditioned to follow the sort of education pathway and the conformity that it sort of bred the willingness to be entrepreneurial out of the UK. That's his take on it anyway.
Yeah, I think there's the that French philosopher that Peter Thiel sometimes quotes, René Girard, which is around this whole like mimetic theory, right? Everybody goes to university because everybody else goes to university. Everyone then wants to go work in law, consulting, banking because everyone else does it and it's seen as you know, prestigious. And so everyone sort of like follows this path and you get a huge concentration of talent. And it's hugely like a huge issue in the UK because we're sort of that book, The Butlers to the World, helping people move money around. And you get this huge concentration of talent in these industries. And actually, if you just abstracted yourself from that sort of like mimetic wheel in many ways and you know, decided that I want to go and build the best garden center in the world, right? And you just concentrated all of your talent and energies in it, you probably actually have much more success and enjoyment. I mean, Matt Clifford at the Entrepreneur First, I think he often quotes this report around in years when there was sort of like economic downturn and banks and consultancies hired less people, those people who were sort of almost couldn't get into those jobs and were forced entrepreneurs in many ways, they set up businesses and actually those people ended up being more successful than normal entrepreneurs, etc.
That's a great that's a great stat. Like I'd love to see that and to check it, but that sounds awesome. I would love that to be really true. You know, I'm sure it is because you know, Entrepreneur First is a great scheme, but I just that's the type of thing I would love to be true, really true.
Yeah, I think as a country we have huge wealth of talent, but we probably concentrate too much on finance.
What do you think? Because obviously you see it at the sharp end. You must. How many entrepreneurs do you think you meet with every month, quarter, year, like roughly, founders?
I try to meet somebody most days. So you know.
So you're probably meeting like 200 a year. I don't know. Call it.
Yeah, 200 a year. Then you know, I've done a few other things where I try to speak more with, you know, operators, people actually like building companies. So yeah, like a huge number.
I mean, like what's your sort of take on how this could be improved? Like I know there's schemes like Entrepreneur First and things like that, but what kind of structural stuff could we do, do you think, in the UK?
I think it's a good question. I guess there's like, in my mind, there's like, I don't know, two thoughts. There's one is from a venture perspective, I just think that the reality is this industry is so heavily power law distributed that in hindsight, you know, every year, maybe there's, I think the common quip in the US is there's like 20 to 25 businesses every year that are actually worth funding in retrospect.
Is that right?
And so let's just say like in the UK there's maybe five businesses that are actually built that can potentially be these like venture scale outcomes that can be $1 billion companies, which makes sense, right? These companies like should be relatively rare. It's extremely hard to do. And So I think you can increase the potential pool of entrepreneurs, but in reality, the actual, you know, it's, you need a lot of things to happen. You need extremely, extremely obsessed founders with unique insights, working really hard in markets and hopefully getting quite lucky. But I think there's a sort of a more general sense of, you know, SME businesses are a huge driver of GDP growth, the economy. More entrepreneurship 100% should be encouraged. I think you've got to sort of try and change some of the like relative prestige that's maybe put on, you know, the person coming out of a top university who studied maths wanting to become a quant at Jane Street versus, you know, starting their own business. And I think this is why maybe I delineate the two, because I don't think everybody needs to scale a venture business, right? You know, you can be a very successful entrepreneur, sell a business for the 50 million, you know, maybe you take one round of angel funding and you and your co-founder both make 20 million. I mean, for the rational human, that's a great outcome.
Yeah, I feel like that's exactly like that route and those different options need to be sort of, you know, shared, discussed, you know. But I think that makes total sense. I think that it's a really interesting area. I think it's going to become a lot more relevant in the UK, actually, because the new government's going to have to figure out a way to scale growth somehow. They have to, you know, and like you just said, SMEs, which effectively is what a startup is, are huge sources of employment, of additional revenue, of additional IP, R&D, you know, export value, and are able to scale and spin up a lot quicker than more established businesses. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what the new government does to try and stimulate that stuff. Like, I know like the old government kind of cut R&D tax credits and they did a whole bunch of other things, but I think it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen. Yeah. So I think one of the things I was going to mention is I'm privileged enough to be on the NHS England advisory board for SMEs for the whole UK. Us and PocDoc were one of the 8 participants in that, which we're hugely privileged and honoured to be on. And without wishing to break any rules, at the last meeting, one of the statistics that was discussed was that 75% of all services to the NHS are delivered by SMEs.
Okay, really interesting.
So like they're not necessarily VC backed the entire time, but that cohort of SMEs is so critical to the delivery of health and care in the UK. It's underpinned by small and medium sized enterprises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it really highlights the point.
So we are going to go for our final commercial break now on this week's Health Tech Hour, and we'll be back after 2 minutes with my guest this week, Jamie Tomlin, who's a lead investor at Triple Point Ventures.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Jamie, just before the break, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour. Before the break, you mentioned a term a few times, which I just want to clarify for everyone, which is TAM, which is total addressable market. So that might not be something that everyone's immediately familiar with, but what is it, and why is it so critical for venture investors?
Yeah, so I guess the heuristics of an early stage investor, or I guess the VC model in general, is that the majority of the companies that early stage investors that they invest into will ultimately fail. Like, venture portfolios follow this power law distribution, and the vast majority of returns in any given portfolio tend to accrue to, you know, one or two of the companies. And so every investment that somebody makes, they need to believe can be that company that returns the fund. And I guess back solving from that logic, you need the company to be building in a market that is large enough to support an outcome to be sort of a unicorn, right?
Which is valued at over $1 billion or pounds.
Yeah, valued over $1 billion. I guess multiples are compressed now. So maybe you need that business to have, say, 250, 300 million of revenue. And so the reality is, if you're building in a market that itself is a total addressable market and existing spend in that market is only 300 million, well, I've got to believe that you as a company are going to get 100% penetration in this market for me to sort of have that outcome. Which is clearly difficult. So I guess, it's a roundabout way of saying that people are looking for very large total addressable markets that can potentially support these large outcomes.
So I think what's really interesting about venture capital, and that's why I kind of asked the question, is this concept of a power law. So I think that there's lots of people that think about businesses, and there are lots of businesses out there that could be successful and might be successful, and there might be customers. And, you know, like a really good example would be businesses that offer IT solutions to GP services, right? There's lots of there's lots of GP practices, and they all need IT solutions. That's a pretty good business, I'm guessing. You know, if you're in that business and you've got contracts, and they probably really sticky and generate revenue, and you can do it profitably if you control your costs. But that isn't necessarily something that's going to get venture capital excited, because venture capital, like you said, follows this power law where any investment that they make needs to return the fund, and the fund may be valued, that might be 200, 300, 500 or more millions. So you have to believe in those businesses being enormous. And if they're not, they've got the potential of being enormous because the market isn't big enough, that's a no-go for you guys, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. And I guess this is also why, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to understand the size of the fund that you are being invested from. Like, if somebody is investing out of a 50 or 100 million pound seed fund, the outcome needed to return that fund is going to be lower than, you know, a bigger investor coming in, investing out of a $1 billion fund. It's just the reality, right? So I think it's always important to understand the incentives of everybody involved. And I guess there's even more nuance, right, depending on when in a fund cycle an investor is investing. If you are the first check out of a brand new fund, you are going to have more time as an investment to mature, versus if you are the last ticket out of a fund, right, there's going to be a shorter time horizon that they're going to want you to exit as a business. So I think, as an entrepreneur, you've got to be acutely aware of who's investing in you, the dynamics of their fund, etc.
That makes sense. I think it's just, it's interesting because, you know, been through the journey myself, on the journey, you know, a few times, not just with PocDoc, but previously. And it's a unique way of thinking about the world, you know, and it takes a while to understand it, I think, as an entrepreneur, because it doesn't mean that your business isn't good. Doesn't mean that you can't find customers. Doesn't mean that you can't generate revenue. Doesn't mean any of those things. Doesn't mean you're not a good entrepreneur or anything. It just means that for that particular fund, that they don't have a confidence in the overall size of your market, meaning they couldn't invest, because by definition, you wouldn't be able to be potentially one of the winners at the level that they need you to be, which is just an interesting way. I mean, you used the way heuristic, which makes sense. It's like an interesting viewpoint, I think.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think actually one of the odd things that's happened in the last sort of 3 to 5 years is that lots of venture capital funds have become quasi-media orgs, right? And they're producing so much content, thought leadership, have all of these vast followings. And it's almost sort of like distorting people's perspective of like what entrepreneurship and building a business is, right? Like, going on the venture capital track is one very specific, high-octane way of building a business. That really should only be attracting the most irrational, obsessed founders, because, you know, the reality is nobody really needs to build a $1 billion company and make that much money, right? You just don't really need to. And you can still create a huge amount of value in this world and improve, you know, patient outcomes by taking different routes. But I think we've sort of been slightly distorted by this sort of like barrage of media, et cetera, and thought leadership from VCs.
I agree. And I do think that there's like a lack of. So when I think about entrepreneurs, really entrepreneurs that have it really hard, I think about people running hairdressers or, you know, butcher shops or, you know, taxi businesses or whatever it happens to be, right? Like running a plastering company or a decorating company, like that's really hard. You know, like no, there's nobody you can go to pretty much for funding there. Maybe you can get a loan from the bank. Maybe. Yep. That's really hard. You know, the high octane is a really good way of doing it. It's like there are people that want to give startups, businesses money. You know, it's a very sort of privileged but very different pathway. And I think that there's a bit of a lack of discussion or appreciation of those other pathways, you know. That yeah. Like that there are other ways to build businesses and run businesses and be successful. So I think it's a really, I just think it's a really interesting kind of discussion and debate to be had. Because there's also a kind of a perception of sort of, you know, if you can't build a business that gets funded by venture capital, maybe you're not, quote, a good entrepreneur, which I think is insane. You know what I mean? And I think that that creates this real like binary outcome to the whole proceeding, which I don't think you win or you lose. I don't think that's very helpful generally.
I completely agree. Yeah, and it's and I think you get this sort of like the negative second order consequences is when, you know, becoming a venture backed entrepreneur can be glamorous, and then people starting businesses more for the ego or perhaps the like social bread / external validation that it provides, rather than actually wanting to like build a business and solve a problem. And I think that has lots of consequences as well. It's an interesting dynamic. I mean, ultimately, I think that like true people who actually like are fundamentally entrepreneurial are quite rare, and yeah, they're a rare breed of people.
Yeah. So I think there's this guy, Simon Squibb. I don't know if you follow him. Do you follow him, Simon Squibb, on Instagram?
I don't know. Maybe I should.
Yeah, he's really cool, actually. So he's like, I'm not sure exactly what his journey's been, but he's an older guy. But basically, he's sort of built this huge following by going around and just sort of asking people in the street or driving a bus or doing the cleaning in the top, like what your dream is. And then sort of trying to help them get there and sort of challenging them, and like he'll ask someone like, what's your dream, and they'll be driving the bus and it'll be like, I'd love to open up a food stall, and then he'd be like, well, what's stopping you? And they're like, oh, I need some money. And then you're like, well, how much money? And the guy will be like, well, I need like 500 quid. And he'll say, well, if you quit right now, I'll give you 500 quid and we can do it together. And he'll sort of like forces people to think through how they can get what their dream is, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really interesting approach. And his view, sorry to come around to it, is that in the UK, the education system is such that it sort of almost discourages that independence of thought and that sort of unique approach of what that you need to be able to sort of not just follow your dream, but actually sort of not just follow the prescribed career route. To actually sort of back yourself, or at least have a crack. It might not work and you can always change and go do something else, but that sort of we've been so conditioned to follow the sort of education pathway and the conformity that it sort of bred the willingness to be entrepreneurial out of the UK. That's his take on it anyway.
Yeah, I think there's the that French philosopher that Peter Thiel sometimes quotes, René Girard, which is around this whole like mimetic theory, right? Everybody goes to university because everybody else goes to university. Everyone then wants to go work in law, consulting, banking because everyone else does it, and it's seen as you know, prestigious. And so everyone sort of like follows this path, and you get a huge concentration of talent. And it's hugely like a huge issue in the UK because we're sort of that book, The Butlers to the World, helping people move money around. And you get this, huge concentration of talent in these industries. And actually, if you just abstracted yourself from that sort of like mimetic wheel in many ways and you know decided that I want to go and build the best garden center in the world, right, and you just concentrated all of your talent and energies in it, you probably actually have much more success and enjoyment. I mean, Matt Clifford at the Entrepreneur First, I think he often quotes this report around in years when there was sort of like economic downturn and banks and consultancies hired less people, those people who are sort of almost couldn't get into those jobs and were forced entrepreneurs in many ways, they set up businesses, and actually those people ended up being more successful than normal entrepreneurs, etc.
That's a great that's a great stat. Like, I'd love to be able to see that and to check it, but that sounds awesome. I would love that to be really true. You know, I'm sure it is, because you know, Entrepreneur First is a great scheme, but that's the type of thing I would love to be true, really true.
Yeah, I think as a country, we have huge wealth of talent, but we probably concentrate too much on finance.
What do you think? Because obviously you see it at the sharp end. You must. How many entrepreneurs do you think you meet with every month, quarter, year, like roughly, founders?
I try to meet somebody most days. So, you know,